Deutschlandfunk. Corso. Kunst und Pop.
I will start the interview with the first sentence of the movie Woodstock. And ABC reporter asks you this question on site, on location. What is the worst part of running such a thing like this? I asked you the same question. Way back then you said politics. What's your opinion on that now with 40 years in between? Your answer.
It's the same answer. And it's been the same in all of the Woodstock events we've done.
What kind of politics you're talking about?
You know, town politics, state politics, federal politics, regulations, complying with all of the regulations that were cited in the mass gathering permit that they designed after Woodstock. It's become a problem. But at the time, it was getting people to understand what we were trying to do and getting them to feel comfortable with it.
So what was it that you tried to do way back then?
I think pretty much what we did, which was bring together a generation of kids to try and experience what it would be like to live in the world we envisioned.
It is often said now, 40 years after, that when Woodstock came on, the spirit of the hippie generation was already at the end. What was your state of mind concerning this?
Well, obviously it wasn't at the end. I think it may have been at the peak. You know, things were getting weird. There were lots of violent things going on in the country then. We were still protesting the Vietnam War, still fighting for human rights issues and ecological issues. The Green Movements were just beginning then. But we'd been through a generation of struggle for creating the kind of atmosphere in the world that we thought we wanted to live in, where people related to each other in a very sort of positive, respectful way, where we weren't involved in things that were immoral or none of our affair, like the Vietnam War. And we felt that freedoms, personal freedoms, were critical to all of us and that we were all entitled to that. And Woodstock was, I guess, the culmination of all of those activities. We could sort of step back, produce this event for ourselves without outside influence, and see how it felt to live that dream.
When you and Artie tried to look for some spots in Woodstock, you found some spots, but then you had to call them off. How did you find finally the location?
Actually, we never found a place in Woodstock that was big enough. We found a site in Saugerties. I found it through a friend of mine, Jim Young, who I'd hired early on, sometime around November, December of 68, to help look for a spot. And we found this perfect place in Saugerties and spoke to those people, and they seemed interested. And by the time we got around to speaking with them again, after we made the deal with John Roberts and Joel Rosenman to finance the event, they had changed their mind. They heard rumors about what we were planning, and they changed their mind. So we started to look again for a site and spent a long time looking, and finally wound up in Wallkill at a site that was not ideal, but it was available.
How did you end up in Bethel?
We lost Wallkill. On July 14th, they turned down our permit applications. Sometime during the month of May, they decided they were going to pass a law that required permits. When we first arrived there, there were no permits required. And so they put together this local law, number 11, I think it was, which required permitting, and then proceeded to turn down the permits. And that came down, the final decision came down on July 14th. And so I immediately got my crews packing up the offices and realizing that if we went to court, we'd never make the festival date, which was a month away, and put a lot of people on telephones talking to all the media, letting them know that we had lost our site, that we were looking for a site. And miraculously, the next day, somebody called, Elliot Tiber called from Bethel, said he had a permit and a place for us to do it, and we went up to look. I went up with my assistant, Tisha Bernuth, and Mel Lawrence and Stan Goldstein. And it was a derelict motel, and behind it was a swamp. And that was what he'd presented us with, and of course it didn't work. But since we were in beautiful farm country, I asked if there was someone who could show us around. And we came up over a hill, and there was the Field of Dreams. You know, it was certainly the field of my dreams. And It was owned by Maxie Oscar, who was a local dairy farmer, probably the leading businessman in the community. We went to Max's house, told him what we had in mind. He knew about us. He'd heard about Wallkill, and he happened to need some money that summer because his hay crop wasn't coming in well, and he had to buy additional hay for his cattle. So he was it was fortuitous for him and for us, and we made a deal on the spot that day. The day after losing our site in Wallkill, we had a new site in Bethel.
Can you remember how your feeling was or what you felt when you came over the hill and saw the location for the first time?
It was like a dream come true. It was just the perfect place. I knew it was ours. I knew immediately that that's where the festival would be.
What were the biggest challenges to pull it off then within 1 month?
Preparing the site was the biggest challenge because we had to do in 1 month what we had planned for 4 months. And we had to bring water, power, sewage, toilets, food, concession stands, stages, everything that you need to sort of put a festival like this on and create a temporary city for a couple of 100,000 people. We were building for 200,000. That's what we planned on. And it was 24/7. We hired additional crews. We got anybody we could to come in and help prepare. And it was just a huge challenge for us. For all of the utility companies, I mean, they had to bring power and telephone from 8 miles away, and those guys worked around the clock for us as well.
And then a lot of people came, more than you expected. And I always, when I read about Woodstock, it is a funny thing. On the one hand, everyone talks about this great festival, but then there's this criticism that the organization was so chaotic and bad.
Well, it was great organized for 200,000. It was not great organized for 500,000 there and 1.5 million on the road trying to get there. But I think it's to our credit that we were well enough organized to have been able to handle 500,000 people and get everybody through the weekend safely and with great music and a great feeling. We had prepared ourselves well. Nobody expected a crowd of that size. It had never happened in the history of the planet, I think. So to have expected us to anticipate that is absurd. 200,000 people was probably four times the size of a crowd anybody had had at a festival before Woodstock. So I think, you know, they may have criticisms of it, but people have to remember that there was no festival business then. There was no precedent. There was no plan that we could go to formulate, you know, our designs from. We had to invent it as we went along. And I think looking at the results and the fact that there's never been such a peaceful, harmonious event, you know, in the history, certainly of music, I don't take that criticism to heart.
Why do you think that so many critics, especially at 40 years of Woodstock, tend to criticize the event? A lot of writers or even people who were there say like it's overrated or I don't know.
You know, I that's not my experience. I haven't seen that. I've done tremendous amount of press. People from all over the world, like yourself, are coming in to talk about Woodstock. So obviously they don't think it was overrated. They wouldn't be interested. And all of the articles and all the interviews I've seen have been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, there's always, you know, an advantage to taking the opposite opinion and the opposite view. It creates interest, I guess. But from what I've seen, it's been overwhelmingly positive.
What do you think, although so many people came, it didn't fall apart?
It didn't fall apart, as I say, because the ground was well laid. You know, we brought in elements that we felt would ensure that people would respond the right way, that this was a countercultural event produced by the counterculture, which I felt that I was part of. There were lots of violence at shows all over the planet that summer, especially in the United States. People thought music should be free, didn't want to buy tickets, and we planned for all of that. We planned with free stages and free campgrounds, free admission if you didn't want to buy a ticket or couldn't afford to. You would get fed, you would hear the music, and you would be able to camp and be a part of the event. We wanted it to be all-inclusive. We had our own internal police dressed as a peace force without arms. We eliminated all confrontation. We wanted to give this generation of kids the opportunity to prove themselves, and I was a part of that proof. And I think that they performed brilliantly. We brought the hog farm in, for example, to help set up the campgrounds and set a vibe amongst the people who were coming. These were city kids. They were not used to living in the country or camping out in the country for a period of days. So the Hawk Farm would welcome the groups as they came in, help them set the campgrounds up and start to acclimate them to how to get along in the country, and then encourage them to help the next group that came in. So this feeling of cooperation and that we were all in it together was introduced right from the beginning and spread throughout the weekend. And I think that's has a lot to do with why it works so well.
So you think that the crowds also played a big part in how it turned out? I mean, it went all wrong a few months later.
They played the major part in how it went. I mean, it was the audience that came together as a community and treated each other with respect as brothers and sisters and shared everything, you know, and pulled together to really get through the weekend in a very positive way. What happened in Altamont a few months later was really the antithesis of what happened at Woodstock. It was not planned at all. It was thrown together at the last minute. It was really stupidly designed. I mean, to bring the Hells Angels in to be security is an insane move, frankly.
But didn't, like, the counterculture always had a flirt with the Hells Angels in the 60s?
Yeah, but not as security. I mean, they weren't the guys to stick between the audience and the stage and have them defend anything. It wasn't something they should have to have done. They could have been there and partied, and it would have been great. But they were given that responsibility, and it just disintegrated on the spot.
What were your biggest challenges concerning things like this? I read that the Yippies, for example, wanted to blackmail you to pay some money. Otherwise, they would float the festival with bad acid. Is that true?
No, they never threatened to poison anybody. That's absurd. They did try and hold us up for money, and they felt that we were ripping off the counterculture. And my argument was that we were the counterculture, and that, you know, these things don't happen free, and somebody's got to pay for them. And it's, as long as it's a fair amount, and as long as you give more than you get, there shouldn't be any reason why it was looked at as anything other than a countercultural event. That if we really wanted to get anything accomplished in our desire to sort of demonstrate our ideas, we'd better get real about it. And instead of sending them away, I incorporated them into the event, brought them in, made them a part of it. Put out a survival paper every day so the kids could understand some of the ground rules. And eventually Abby Hoffman, who was sort of the leader of that coalition, went to work in the hospital tents and helped through days of organization up on the hills. And I think that Movement City, which was the place that we allocated for people to put out their papers and different political groups to make known their ideas, was deserted on the first day because everything that they were putting their papers out about and the stances they were taking was already happening before their very eyes. I mean, we were the counterculture, and that's the point of what I was trying to get across. I always felt the biggest political statement we could make was to have this work in a very positive, peaceful way, and that's what happened.
Way back then in the 60s, there were a lot of drugs, different drugs around. How did you, like, make secure that it was not, like, turning into a big drug fest that you couldn't control? Was there something like you tried to control this side of the organization as well?
You can't control 500,000 people. And there were no more drugs around than there were in any other given day when these people were at home. The drugs of that era were much kinder and friendlier. They were much more spiritual. It was marijuana and LSD. There weren't very many hard drugs. When we saw hard drugs being used or sold, we removed those people. You know, one of the things that was so good about the hog farm is that they were part of the acid tests, the Kool-Aid acid tests in California, the Kankakee acid tests. And so they were very used to dealing with people who were having bad reactions to certain drugs and knew how to bring them out of it in a very safe and reassuring way. All of the off-duty cops who we had hired to be security were interviewed very, very thoroughly to make sure that they had the right response. If they saw somebody smoking a joint, it was not their job to do anything about it. If they saw somebody selling heroin, it was. They were there to help people through the weekend. And so we, of course, were very cognizant of the potential problems, and we did whatever we could to mitigate them.
How did you experience the festival? Was there even a chance for you to enjoy it?
I loved every minute of it.
Okay, this is a very nice smile that you put on your face right now. What was the greatest moment of Woodstock for you?
I mean, it was a whole defining experience, but I guess the moment that stands out most in my mind is when we finally went from planning to doing, when Richie Havens finally got on stage and started to sing and the sound system worked and we were off and running.
Was there one moment where you thought, like, it could turn into chaos?
You know, I never had that feeling. There was a sense in the crowd which grew and grew for days beforehand. So it wasn't like all of a sudden there was a field full of people. But the sense in the crowd as things grew was an amazing feeling of camaraderie. And there was no music for several days, and there were 80,000 people in the field by Thursday while we were still building. But there's just the sensibility in the crowd, the way people responded to each other, the way they got into the idea of 3 days of peace and music and nothing but peace and music was very, very palpable. It was very strong, and I felt very secure in that.
What I wondered is, like, if you organize and participate in a way like you did with Woodstock, and you have to talk and explain it to people like me all over again, and is there a danger, like, to fall for the own myth?
That's why I wrote the book. I wrote a book called The Road to Woodstock, which is my memoir of what happened. And in that book, I describe exactly what happened from beginning to end, what my thinking was, what I tried to accomplish, how we tried to accomplish it, what my partners were doing, what the staff was made up of, how we did the bookings, how we laid out the grounds. The whole adventure story is there. I thought it was important to get that down one time from an accurate perspective, which I think could only have come from me because I was really the only one who understood it all as we were doing it.
I read that you wanted to put on a anniversary festival here in New York in Prospect Park. It didn't happen. What went wrong?
It was an anniversary festival that was supposed to be celebrating Climate Week in New York. Climate Week is something that the UN is doing. It's the precursor to the Copenhagen meetings, which will discuss what happens with climate issues in the coming decade. It's an important issue, and I thought Woodstock would be a useful tool to get that word out. We wanted to do a free show.
You wanted to put on a anniversary festival here in New York in Prospect Park. It didn't happen. What went wrong?
It was an anniversary festival that was supposed to be celebrating Climate Week in New York. Climate Week is something that the UN is doing. It's the precursor to the Copenhagen meetings, which we'll discuss what happens with climate issues in the coming decade. It's an important issue, and I thought Woodstock would be a useful tool to get that word out. We wanted to do a free show in Prospect Park, and so we thought about how to put that together. And a free show is a free show, but it costs a lot of money. So because it was a sustainable issue and because it had to be a very green event, we could only use green sponsorship. Unfortunately, this year was a very difficult one economically for most companies, especially green companies who are just trying to get, you know, on their feet. So it was just the wrong timing for that kind of thing. That's why it didn't happen.
But Woodstock is a good brand to say so. I mean, many critics also say that with Woodstock, commercialization started with like the hippie sellout, like the record company found out, wow, there is a real market for this counterculture.
Yeah, for youth culture in general, they had no idea there were that many of us. And so it looked like a market to everybody. And of course, they were marketed to. But that's the free enterprise system. There's no way around that. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, frankly. I think, you know, people have the right to discern what they want to buy into and what they don't. I have no problem, you know, sort of combining art and commerce. I think as long as it's done properly and fairly and with quality and with authenticity, then it's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, and the ones that are strictly commercializing aspects of any event or anything, any brand, really, you know, that'll seek its own level. The public will figure it out.
I think that you and Mr. Kornfeld started the whole thing anyhow, like to finance a studio, a recording studio in Woodstock. Is that true?
That's sort of myth. There were two separate projects. I was interested in starting a recording studio in Woodstock because a lot of musicians live there. I thought, the ideal way to record a record away from the cities, you know, in a very relaxed, creative atmosphere. And also, I had been going to Soundouts that summer, and Soundouts were concerts done on a farm just outside of town, out under the stars in the country, beautiful fields. It was, I thought, the perfect way to listen to music. I had done a festival the year before called the Miami Pop Festival in 1968. Hendrix closed that event as well. Those two events for me are what kind of formulated my ideas for what the basis of Woodstock would be. We were looking to finance a studio when we met John Roberts and Joel Roseman because they had a company called Challenge International, and they had just financed Media Sound in New York. And our lawyer thought they might be interested in the festival, and I mean in the studio in Woodstock. And eventually we made an agreement with them. We signed a contract in February for both projects, for the studio and for the festival.
Talking about your partners, are you still good friends with those who live today?
Very good friends, yeah. I talk to Artie 3 or 4 times a week. Joel and I are still partners.
Because the financial situation for the producers, for the financiers, didn't look too good after Woodstock.
Actually, they looked great. We were not mature enough to see it. We had a tremendous amount of goodwill. We had a great event recorded on film and on tape. Had we had our wits about us, we would have done very well financially with that. But because it was a panic situation, because John's family came in and didn't appreciate the fact that he was involved in it at all, and it was his money that was at stake, the partnership broke up and they sold out their interest to Warner Brothers. It was just, you know, we were too young to really deal with it properly.
What did you do, like, after Woodstock?
I mean, I knew immediately I had to go get away from Woodstock. It's the kind of thing where when you do something that dramatic or that large in your life when you're young, you stand the risk of comparing everything else you do to that event. And I knew that that was a big mistake. So I just shut it off and went off to do other things. I started working. I started a record company. I produced other events. I consulted on many events. I did some television production. You know, I've never really had a very straight career path. It was always more doing things that interested me, new ideas, new concepts. And so I went and pursued the things that I was interested in.
Did you call yourself a hippie boy back then? And how changed that after Woodstock?
I didn't call myself anything. I just was what I was. I mean, it was part of the counterculture. I had moved to Coconut Grove 4 years before that to open a head shop. Started an underground newspaper, was involved in lots of political issues, but I was also involved in commerce. So nothing's changed.
And you still got your long hair.
I do.
What are your current projects, Michael?
I'm working on a musical based on the summer of 1969 called The Summer of 69 at the moment. It's a working title. I'm working on a film which is based on a Russian novel called The Master and Margarita by Bulgakov. Mikhail Bulgakov, amazing book. I'm working on another Broadway musical, which is based on a person's life, and we're working on several Woodstock-related issues. We're in the middle of developing a website called Woodstock.com, which opened about 6 weeks ago with Sony Legacy, and hopefully that'll be a site about sustainable living and community and music, and will be sort of a great tool for people to use. And other Woodstock projects, we're always looking for things to make use of Woodstock's fame.
Did she take any part in Ang Lee's movie, Taking Woodstock?
My God.
And did you see it?
I saw it. I saw the movie in the premiere, and we just had it up in Woodstock as a fundraiser for our Woodstock Film Festival. And I had a really good time. I thought it was delightful. It's a nice story. It's not exactly historically accurate, but it's... Ang certainly captures the essence of what that was like and the innocence and the sweetness of the people, and highlights the audience as really the star of that event. And it's an interesting story about Elliot Tiber, the guy who called me, you know, to White Lake in the first place, and how the arrival of myself and my staff and Woodstock in general changes everybody's life, particularly his. It's a small story which tells the bigger story.
Where you gonna be the weekend of the 15th of August till the 18th of August?
I hope at home.
There's one concert going on in Woodstock. I think the remaining members of Kenneth Heat, Jefferson Airplane are playing. Are you attending this, and do you have anything to do with that?
No, we're not attending it. I mean, I'm not attending it. As I say, I plan on being at home. There is a concert at Bethel Woods, which is where the original festival happened with a lot of those bands. And if somebody wants to, you know, be a part of that, I think it'll probably be fun, a fun weekend there. Levon Helm is playing, and he's wonderful. And some of the other bands I haven't heard, but I understand that they're pretty decent. But we're also doing things around the country. I think there's about 45 events that we put together with the School of Rock, which is a school for kids who are doing classic rock music, and they're doing Woodstock songs all that weekend in all over the country. It's a way of sort of passing the torch and showing where the roots of today's music comes from. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, I think, my favorite. It's called Kidstock.